Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, World Environment Day, one Franciscan expert looks at the challenges and the concerns. A new ecumenical initiative for faithful and visitors in Dublin for the International Eucharistic Congress, and a focus on peace building with a leading Catholic expert on terrorism. Combating climate change and water scarcity and supporting agricultural entrepreneurs for sustainable food security. Those are just some of the issues at the heart of World Environment Day on June 5th. The theme for 2012, Green Economy, Does It Include You? Well, the United Nations Environment Program describes the green economy as one that results in improved human well-being and social equity, while significantly reducing environmental risks and ecological scarcities. A green economy, then, is an economic environment that achieves low carbon emissions, resource efficiency, and at the same time is socially inclusive. For a green economy to work, then, it must begin at an individual level. Hence the question, does it include you? Well, with a global population of 9 billion people projected by the year 2050, countries are increasingly hard-pressed to guarantee food and water security, and demand could soon exceed supply. According to estimates from the Food and Agriculture Organization, 1.8 billion people will be living in countries or regions with absolute water scarcity by 2025. Moreover, the UN says world resources continue to be exploited unsustainably, leading to dire environmental degradation. Well, immediate interventions are needed to curb this situation, and delegates to the UN Conference on Sustainable Development will be discussing these from June 20th to 22nd in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Dubbed the Rio Plus 20, the conference marks the 20th anniversary of the 1992 UN Conference on Environment and Development in Rio. Well, as director of the Franciscans OFM Office for Justice, Peace, and the Integrity of Creation, Father Joe Rosansky will be among a delegation of some 60 Franciscans to go to Brazil for the Rio Plus 20 and other meetings on the sidelines. In this interview with me, he raises the alarm on several environmental issues at stake and begins with what we should be remembering on World Environment Day.
I think probably above all we need to remember the when we talk about creation, we think about, you know, the God that has done everything around us, you know, that has created the world, the environment in which we live, and has created us. Especially as Franciscans, we like to think about that all together in the sense that, you know, if you look to St. Francis and the Canticle of the Creatures, for example, Francis praises God for Brother Sun, for Sister Moon, for all of the good things of the earth, but he does it as a relationship. You know, so the plants and the animals and the sun and the moon are brothers and sisters to us. And he does this because, you know, he believes in the familial aspect of being creation. You know, so for Francis, God created us all. We stand together with the creation as creatures of God. So when we talk about Environment Day, you know, we do talk about, you know, thanking God for what we have around us. You know, but in our Franciscan spirit, we also thank God for the fact that we're all family. You know, that Brother Sun, Sister Moon, and all the plants and animals, you know, help us to survive. And we're in it together, in a sense. So when we celebrate Environment Day, we're celebrating the fact that we need to be there for one another. And I think one of the biggest things that we need to look at now is the crisis that we find ourselves in, you know, in terms of environment and climate change and the major threats that are taking place today against the environment. So I think that's kind of like what we need to try to celebrate. We need to celebrate the relationship that should be there and maybe at times is not. You know, we need to work at being brother and brothers and sisters to one another, and also to God's creation.
Now, you are going to be part of a group of Franciscans going to the Rio Summit on the Environment. Of course, that's 20 years on from the first one. What are you bringing with you? What are you going to be presenting there?
In Rio, it's really a double meeting. There is the UN meeting, which is actually the Rio Plus 20. It's a celebration of 20 years of work at the UN for the environment. But at the same time, alongside the UN meeting is the People's Summit. And at the People's Summit, it's civil society, NGOs, religious, et cetera, people who are concerned with the environment and who are kind of tracking what's going on at Rio. So for us, we have a group of about 60 Franciscans that I know of. I'm hoping there'll be others there too, Franciscans as well. But we're going there in a double capacity. We have an NGO that works at the UN called Franciscans International, and they will be at the official part of the UN meeting, and they'll be following what's going on there, and they'll keep the rest of us informed about what's going on at the official meetings, where they will be talking about sustainability, where they're going to be evaluating these last 20 years of what's gone on, etc. Now, on the outside, at the People's Summit, we're going to be together there reflecting with many people of goodwill about the same thing, evaluating what's gone on in the last 20 years. And I think that there's a little bit of, not a little bit, there's a lot of concern about what has not happened. We haven't been caring for creation in the way that we need to do to keep things sustainable. You know, if we talk about climate change is getting worse. It's creating greater effects in our world today, and it's one of the problems that we see, one of the threats that we see to the world. You know, so from the outside looking into the UN conference, we want to ask them, why is it that way? What are the real concerns that we have in the world today? I think one of our biggest concerns is, I'm not sure if you followed it, but there's been a proposal for green economy. You know, and the idea for many people sounds very positive, you know, that our economic policies would also take into account environmental issues. But for many people, there's a fear that we talk about whitewashing things. Well, they feel that this is a greenwash, and that using certain kinds of vocabulary, people are going to be satisfied that something's happening. Well, there is a major concern that there is not enough happening, or that what's being sold as green economy is really, in a sense, an excuse to keep things going the way that they have been going. There's also a major concern about the commodification of the goods, of the common goods of our world, things like air and water, et cetera, you know, things that people have held in common. And now part of the proposal of the green economy is that these things would be commodified. I mean, there's been a big fight going on about water for a while now. And, you know, we've been talking lately about how there'll be wars for water like there have been wars for petroleum. You know, so we're very concerned about the common goods of the earth and what's going to happen to them in a proposal like the green economy. So for us, from the outside, we're going to be tracking what's going on in Rio. And another big part of our being together in Rio is to ask ourselves, not so much about what's going to happen there, but what we're going to do afterwards, how we're going to follow up on the decisions, on the reflections of both the UN and the People's Summit. You know, how we're going to take that to our constituencies, how we're going to work with the people around the world that, you know, where the Franciscans are active in our schools and our parishes, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you see that the Rio conference, the meetings that you're talking about, is anything concrete going to come out of them?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure. I think that there is a lot of concern that there will not be many concrete things, at least not beyond what we have right now. You know, the Kyoto Protocol came out of the meetings in Rio in 92. if I'm not mistaken, Kyoto was signed in 97. It was about 5 years after the meetings in Rio, you know, after a lot of negotiation, et cetera, et cetera. Right now, the interests are so diverse and the concerns are so different, I'm not quite sure how we're going to be able to bring that together and find a concrete approach to the problem. And, you know, in a sense, that's why we're asking ourselves, you know, what do we need to do to be able to make something good happen in terms of the environment? But not only in terms of the environment, we're really concerned with what we call environmental justice, which brings together both a concern for the environment and a concern for social justice at the same time. Because if you look at the world and you see the continuing poverty that exists, you know, so many people that are homeless, they don't have enough to eat, they don't have education. You know, going back to the idea of the Millennium Goals, you know, they surely have not been met. You know, so we can't just talk about the environment, but we need to talk about environmental justice. And I kind of doubt that there's going to be able to be anything really concrete that comes out of the official meetings at the UN. It's part of what we've been talking about, too. I think that there's a growing frustration with the official level of, you know, the governments and the United Nations about what they are really interested in doing and about whose interests they're really protecting. Because obviously a big player in all of this are the companies. You know, it's the companies that are involved in, well, so many different areas, mining companies, pharmaceutical companies, all these kinds of things.
Father Joe Rozanski, OFM, is director of the Franciscan Office for Justice, Peace, and the Integrity of Creation. Church leaders and faithful from around the world are descending on Dublin, Ireland this week, ahead of the International Eucharistic Congress, which kicks off Sunday and runs through June 17th. Many will be joining a new Camino or pilgrim walk, which began last Saturday and culminates on Saturday, June 16th. The pilgrim walk, inaugurated by the Catholic and Protestant archbishops of the city, takes the faithful on a prayerful pilgrimage to seven Catholic and Anglican churches around Dublin. St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral, seat of the Catholic Archdiocese, will be the final destination for pilgrims taking part in the walk. Emer McCarthy spoke to the Pro-Cathedral administrator, Father Damien O'Reilly, about the importance of this public witness to faith in the Ireland of today.
Oh, we are many, we are one body, we who come to share this living bread, cup of salvation.
One of the ideas that we came up with was having a pilgrim walk within the city based on the Camino walk of Santiago de Compostela. And so, for example, going on a pilgrim walk has had a long history in the life of the church. Pilgrims make a walk to a sacred journey. A sacred journey is a sacrament. As we know, a sacrament being an outward visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace. And so the journey to the historical churches, seven of the oldest churches here in the city of Dublin, is the outward part of that, drawing closer to God. And in prayer, drawing close to him in prayer, is the inward part of that journey. And so those who, we hope, make the pilgrim walk won't return the same as they were when they started off, because pilgrims return from that journey with an encounter with the Lord that will enrich their lives in the everyday world.
You're talking about taking in the oldest churches in Dublin. What is physically the pilgrim walk? How do you do it?
So the pilgrims are expected, in the pilgrim walk, it involves a visit to the seven designated churches here in the city of Dublin. And the churches are St. Anne's Church in Dawson Street, which is the Church of Ireland. Because of the ecumenical dimension to this, to the Congress, which is the first time any Congress has had an ecumenical dimension to it. Our Lady of Mount Carmel in Whitefriars Street, John's Lane in Thomas Street, St. James's Church, which is the church that the Irish pilgrims may leave from to go to Santiago de Compostela. St. Mary of the Angels in Church Street, St. Mitchin's in Halsa Street, being the oldest churches here in the city, and St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral in Marlborough Street, which is the cathedral church for the Archdiocese. Each pilgrim will be issued with a pilgrim passport, which is stamped in each of the churches with the parish stamp. During their visit to the church, they spend time in quiet prayer, concluding their visit to the church with Eucharistic Congress prayer. Spending that time in adoration of the Blessed Sacrament in the churches, the walk will conclude with a visit to St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral in the Cathedral Church, where pilgrims whose passport is stamped with the seal of the Pro-Cathedral, and the pilgrims receive their pilgrimage certificate of completion. So that's basically the layout of the pilgrim walk. They can do it either all in one go, or they may decide to do maybe three churches on one day, or three and three another day, or whatever way they wish to do it, and whichever order they wish to do it. The only church they have to come to, last of all, is St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral, because that's where they get their certificate of completion. And the pilgrim walk is completely free, open to everybody, young and old, right across the board, to be just a time of journeying in faith, and journeying in with great love.
You touched on a very important aspect there when you were describing the churches that are going to be part of this pilgrimage of faith in the Archdiocese of Dublin. And you began by saying St. Anne's on Dawson Street, which is, of course, the Church of Ireland, and that this International Eucharistic Congress in Dublin will be the first to see a very specific ecumenical dimension.
Archbishop Michael Jackson, for example, said that he was most delighted that St. Anne's of Dawson would be associated with this very important initiative and exciting development in the Eucharistic Congress, and being the fact that this Congress is the first Congress to have that ecumenical dimension. The first day of the Monday of the Congress will be an ecumenical day. It will include Archbishop Michael Jackson making the address on that day at the Congress. So I think it's opening us up to that closer unity and working together of the Christian faith. So I think it has an enormous important implication for us. And that was highlighted very much for us on Good Friday, when Archbishop Gerard Martin and Archbishop Jackson walked from Christchurch, having had a short service in Christchurch, walked carrying the cross through the cities of Dublin, right through to the Pro-Cathedral, where it concluded with an evening prayer. And it was a most wonderful experience to see people walking together in faith.
The pilgrim walk is going to conclude in St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral, which, as you said, of course, is the Catholic cathedral for the Archdiocese of Dublin. But people who aren't from Dublin, and perhaps people who aren't from Ireland, won't understand why it's called St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral.
St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral opened its doors way back in 1825. In 1825, Catholic emancipation still hadn't happened in Ireland. And emancipation didn't, although it was imminent, it didn't happen until 1829. When it was opened as the provisional cathedral, pro-cathedral, as there were a number of cathedrals around the country, were provisional cathedrals until after emancipation. And St. Mary's Pro-Cathedral was that provisional cathedral, which is the cathedral church of the cathedral church of the Archdiocese of Dublin.
Now, being the cathedral church of the Archdiocese of Dublin, for many pilgrims who are visiting Dublin for this International Eucharistic Congress, it really is a must to visit. Can you walk us through this place, which is your home, which is where you really are carrying out a very important part of your mission there in the Archdiocese?
Well, it's right in the very heart of the city, just off O'Connell Street, the main street of the city. We open our doors every morning at 7 a.m., and over 1,000 to 1,500 people a day come through the doors of the cathedral, be it for the celebration of Mass, which we have five celebrations of the Eucharist every day. We have available the Sacrament of Reconciliation every day. We have the celebration of evening prayer on a Friday evening with the cathedral choir, the Palestrina choir, the boys of the Palestrina choir. And then we have with benediction. So it's very much, and then in the afternoons every day from lunchtime until the evening Mass, we have Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. So it's very much at the heart of the city of Dublin, where people from all over the diocese and those who visit the diocese, be it from the country or from around the world, come to pray, to spend that time, a little oasis of peace and quiet right in the heart of a very bustling city. So it serves as a very important part of the life and the fabric of the city. And also as a parish in the city, because we have a small number of families living here in the parish now, not as many as there would have been in the past, but certainly we have a number of families who are very part of the life of the Pro-Cathedral as well.
Now, this Congress is extremely important and comes at an extremely important time in the life of the Irish Church. And it's a way that Christians Catholic and Christian, some other churches in Ireland, can come together, particularly on the first day of the Congress, and in a non-aggressive way, but in a very visible way, bring religion back into the public eye and bring the practice of their faith back into the public eye. Is this important right now for Ireland and for Irish Catholics?
Well, within, you know, in our world today, there's a great hunger for this, for God. It was late Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta said, the greatest hunger in the world today is not hunger for food or for water, although it is a great hunger, but the greatest hunger is that hunger for God, that hunger for the spiritual. And amidst all of the difficulties that our world are facing today, a world of fragile peace, a world of many broken promises, is that hunger. And in many ways, the Eucharistic Congress, which at the very heart of the Congress is the Eucharist, is Jesus present in the Eucharist. And that's what makes the Congress so very special. It's Jesus present to us in the Eucharist, and it's the presence of the Lord and the power of God's Holy Spirit gives us this opportunity perhaps to focus yet again on areas perhaps where people may have pushed the Lord out to maybe the fringes of life, or some, in some cases out of life altogether, amidst the hustle and bustle of life or the great strains that are on people's lives, particularly in the economic difficulties that we face as well, and also the challenging times that we face in the life of the Church. So in many ways, the Eucharistic Congress is a very important time and a great opportunity for us here in the Church in Ireland at the moment.
Peace building among communities and faiths has long been a part of Catholic social teaching. And it's not just about building up peace between countries or communities at war. Even when bombs aren't falling and guns fall silent, the Catholic Church says social relationships have to be rebuilt and victims of violence rehabilitated with a vision for the long term. Marianne Cusimano-Love, Associate Professor of International Relations at the Catholic University of America, is one of the Church's leading experts on peacebuilding and an expert on terrorism. She is on the core group for the U.S. State Department's Working Group on Religion and Foreign Policy and serves on the U.S. Catholic Bishops International Justice and Peace Committee. I asked Professor Love how Christians, Muslims, and Jews can contribute to world peace today, and realistically, how can they cooperate towards that goal?
I think one of the things that's important to note is we're at a time when states are challenged around the world in dealing with many problems, from terrorism to ethnic violence to civil wars, and religion is resurgent around the world. So you're looking, where are there some functional capacity that we can have to try to build peace? And religions can be a very important source of that. And I know that seems counterintuitive, you know, because certainly since September 11th, but often religion is painted as the bad guy, the source of war, or else religion is unimportant. You know, the idea that Joseph Stalin said during the Second World War, how many divisions does the Pope have? You know, if you don't have armies, you can't be very important. But I think that really overlooks the tremendous power that religious organizations have in providing education, in providing health care, in providing emergency and humanitarian assistance. And in that work, they build relationships. They build relationships with people on the ground in areas of conflict so that when war comes and governments are not able to respond, who can you talk to who has relationships with the people, who may be able to bring the combatants to the peace table, who certainly are able to serve the displaced, the refugees, the internally displaced, the victims of conflict, and who have a rich on-the-ground knowledge. So I think first is that religious groups can be very helpful and are very helpful in building peace around the world. The second part is how these traditions can work together. And that's increasingly important because not only is religion resurgent and states are challenged, but globalization is mixing. It's mixing everyone together. So increasingly, places that had not been previously pluralistic in religion now are. So we're finding that we have to work together much more than we have been perhaps in the past. And there's been really exciting breakthroughs in that. Archbishop Ledesma from the Philippines, he has been working for almost 30 years now with the Bishops Ulama Dialogue in the southern area of the Philippines, where there's been ongoing conflict. And the imams and the bishops have been working together to build relationships, to build trust across the religious borders, and to help build peace there.
One of the things that Pope Benedict has been urging Catholics to do is to jumpstart this new evangelization. But sometimes evangelization can lead to conversion, and that itself is an issue between different faith communities. How do we not start wars, but we bring peace about through this also, this very Catholic initiative of new evangelization?
Mm-hmm. Evangelization can take many forms. And for the peace builders around the world, one of the most important forms is through our deeds. They will know we are Christians by our love. So Caritas Internationalis, which is one of the main relief and humanitarian aid organizations of the Church, they serve all based on need, not by creed. And they are not allowed in many situations to be passing out Bibles or offering baptism. But many times people, after experiencing the work of the Church and the care of the Church, are so moved by that witness of Christ's presence in the world that they then ask, "Can I know more about your faith? What is it in your faith that brings you to serve me? And I am not of your tribe, of your ethnicity, of your religion, yet you are caring more for me than sometimes people who might share some of those characteristics with me." So I think you're right if you are, that can often cause concerns, but the way we go about it is very important. And if we are known by our deeds, I think that can go quite a long way to generating goodwill. One thing that's very interesting is many times the Church, in areas where they are a minority, are doing workshops across their diocese, across the country, available to people from all faith backgrounds. So training workshops in human rights, in civic participation, in what the constitutional rights are and how they can try to proceed to peacefully resolve conflicts. And so they're using Catholic social teaching, and they're generating these workshops for the population, but not by the basis of creed or ethnic background. These are open to all. So it's very interesting the ways in which even minority, in places where the Church is very much a minority, where they can be kind of a leaven for the larger society.
So I'd like to ask one question about the Middle East and the big sweeping changes that we're seeing there, Middle East and North Africa. Is the international community morally responsible for what happens in that region of the world? And is it accountable for peace between majority and minority communities?
Right. So the responsibility to protect is something that's an emerging norm at the United Nations, an emerging norm in international law, and certainly something the Catholic Church has been very vibrant in pursuing, this responsibility to protect. But the responsibility does not tell you at what point it becomes an obligation to use military force to protect civilians who are being killed by their own government. And, of course, that's the hard part. The responsibility to protect says we all have responsibilities. Most of the responsibilities are non-military in nature. Every way that you can try to prevent the conflict, to avert the conflict, to stop it once it's underway. So military force is the absolute last tier in that system. But at what point does there become an obligation to protect those when their governments are doing the killing? And that's the choice, obviously, that the international community is facing now in Syria and faced last year in Libya. Of course, everyone's hope is that it won't come to that. It's still unknown in the situation in Syria. Who has control of those forces? Does the president have control of the military? Is the military undergoing this on its own? So there's still a lot of questions unknown. But that's where the Church can help build these institutions, can help build the norms about putting humans first, putting people first, whereas the typical response of states is, well, we need to first protect the state. And the churches play a very important role in saying we need to put people first and we need to put human security before state security. And that's where interreligious voices are very important in raising up the important value of human life.
Marianne Love, Associate Professor of International Relations at the Catholic University of America. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudato Jesus Christus.